stop Western citizens taking up the vaccine. That's an incredibly malevolent thing to do that they did that, but that's what happened. And it's interesting to say it's a lot of those things, a lot of those trolls have suddenly disappeared from the internet. I don't see as much activity now as it did even a week ago. But also, we can't forget as well that Rupert Murdoch has also been pushing out a lot of disinformation because he aligns with a lot of the very authoritarian politics that Putin represents. And certainly, Fox News has been pushing out a lot of absolute nonsense and flat-out lies about Putin, Russia, Ukraine, vaccines, all sorts of stuff.
You're mentioning an earlier book that you wrote called Billionaires: The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. And you profile sort of three case studies. And there are Jeff Bezos, Rupert Murdoch, and the Koch brothers. And well, as far as the Koch brothers go, it's down to Charles Koch now. David Koch died in 2019. One of the points you make in the book is that the super rich are not really bound by the laws of any nation.
No, because I mean, the Koch brothers were responsible for the deaths of two teenagers in Texas when my gas pipeline blew up and they were burned alive. And they were like fined massively, millions of dollars for that. But for the Kochs, for the Koch industry, these kind of fines are just the price of doing business, and they'll just brush it off and just get on with that. They're not going to be held personally responsible for the deaths of people. So there is that. And you've got to think, obviously, a big fine would ruin almost any normal person, but it's nothing to these big companies and very powerful individuals. You know, if there was real if the law had teeth, there would be prison time for those people at the very top. But because there isn't, they're able to just get on and do whatever they like, really.
Yeah, it seems like governments are competing to show the most fealty to the super rich. Your profile of Rupert Murdoch, going back to the early 80s in the UK, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and her people would bend the rules or pretty much throw them out the window to give Rupert Murdoch a leg up in the British media landscape.
Certainly, because they got a lot of support back in those days, the 70s. I mean, there was no internet, so newspapers were king. And that's if you wanted to get your propaganda and information across, so you had to have like media barons like Rupert Murdoch on your side. And that's what they did. They worked very closely together, him and Margaret Thatcher, to make sure that she always got back in power if possible. And in return, he got a lot of help in union busting, that kind of thing. So, yeah, they worked hand in glove for many years.
Yeah, here in the US, Rupert Murdoch had no better friend than Newt Gingrich, who was the Republican House Speaker back in the 1990s. He pushed for the deregulation that destroyed all of the safeguards against monopolies, destroyed local news, consolidated media in the hands of a few corporations, such as Murdoch's News Corporation.
Absolutely. What makes incredibly, what I find incredible is that when Margaret Thatcher and in the Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher era in the 70s, 80s, that it was all about from the conservative side, free markets and that kind of thing. But if they've obviously gone against free markets, because if we genuinely wanted free markets, we'd break up a lot of these big companies like Amazon and Google. Let other smaller companies in, but they seem to be fine in letting these huge companies like Apple and so on like gobble up everything and stifle competition. And that's been very bad for us all, I think, that they've been allowed to do this. Certainly, things like Facebook bought Instagram, for example, that shouldn't have been allowed, really. That you know, they just owned too much, really. They should be Disney owns what? Star Wars, 20th Century Fox, Lucasfilm. That's just far too much. I mean, what good does it do to have them to own almost half of Hollywood? And you can, in terms of culture, it leads to sort of homogenous group. amount of stuff, and it doesn't allow smaller companies, it doesn't allow technical innovation or creative innovation. So I'm very against that. And I found myself in coming back to, in a way, a small conservative, old-fashioned conservative point of view politically, in that I too now believe in free markets, when once upon a time I decried them. Now it seems like a good idea.
Well, these legal fictions that we call corporations, they started out a few centuries ago, mainly in England and her colonies. And they were very limited contractual arrangements. They were never meant to stick around for long periods of time or gobble up other corporations or be granted personhood by the courts.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly we should, anti-competitive, anti-monopoly laws exist, but they're not being enforced as they should be. And the government organizations that are supposed to be policing all this are not funding enough, especially in the United States. And not only that, but we're also seeing sort of the revolving door thing as well, where people from the government departments are now hiring people from the very companies supposed to be policing. So if you like, the government departments themselves end up being captured. We saw Trump appointing all sorts of people high up in regulatory positions. Basically, and their job was to destroy that department, like the EPA, for example.
It's interesting that these people who consider themselves populists have lined up behind a New York playboy from a wealthy family. Donald Trump, of course, comes from money. Virtually every billionaire comes from a wealthy family, including the ones in your book. The myth of the self-made tycoon is really just that. It's a myth.
That's absolutely true. I mean, Murdoch inherited millions from his father, who had owned a newspaper already, and he built up from there. The Koch brothers inherited it from their father, Fred, who was super rich already. Bezos is the only one who's slightly different. His stepfather's father was a Cuban immigrant who came to the United States with basically nothing as a child, and he trained himself up to be an oil executive and did very well and got into the middle class. And some of his money was seed money for the origins of the beginning of Amazon. So Bezos may not be a self-made man, but he came from quite low down.
His partners at Amazon were quite wealthy.
Yeah, and he was in a position to get a good investment. It's his father who's the self-made man, if you think about it.
Yeah, some people say that where we once had class mobility, we're now headed towards a new version of feudalism, where the wealthy few own the land, the homes, and the really valuable commodity, all the data.
I'd like to think that the present moment would see people waking up a bit and sort of fighting back generally against all of this, but only time will say, really.
I have to wonder, whatever happened to the Panama Papers? You mentioned the Panama Papers in passing, but there was this big dump of, you know, scandalous information about the super rich that came out, and then just crickets from the corporate media, from the legacy media.
They're not really interested in pushing a lot of these stories because their owners are people like Rupert Murdoch, who benefit from these very beneficial financial systems. So, you know, there is that. So I don't know. And also, it's just hard to try and get people interested in economics anyway. So I do my best.
So another of your graphic nonfiction books is The Age of Selfishness, Ayn Rand, Morality, and the Financial Crisis. And for those who don't know, Ayn Rand was a writer of very clunky novels who ended up influencing major economic thinkers such as Alan Greenspan.
That's right. I mean, she's a key figure in the libertarian movement, really, and considered herself a philosopher. And she was quite a strange woman. She was a Russian emigre, and she came to the US and worked originally around sort of Hollywood, writing screenplays and wrote novels. A very fearsome woman who like a kind of cult started to develop around her. And the young Alan Greenspan was sort of part of that, a 1950 sort of group of libertarian thinkers, really. And he took that, those some of the ideas into the Federal Reserve, you know, when he became chair. And a lot of the deregulation that happened prior to the financial crisis that helped banks sort of become dangerously unstable and financial systems were due to Alice Greenspan in the US, not just deregulating, which he did, but also not really enforcing the regulations that were already in place. So the Randians very much believe in sort of an anti-government sort of stance. The less regulation, the better. But as we've seen, you do really need some regulation, because otherwise things get completely out of control. And in the end, it's the taxpayer who has to pick up the tab for that.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking with Daryl Cunningham, the author of the graphic histories Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our winter membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Our studios are still closed to phone volunteers, but we have all sorts of options for donating. If you'd like to pledge on the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Daryl Cunningham. So you place the economic crash of 2007-2008 squarely at the feet of the followers of Ayn Rand, the libertarians, the free marketeers. These are the people who don't believe in the common good necessarily, don't believe in a healthy middle class. They're sort of a law of the jungle crowd.
Rand wrote a long piece about how she felt that selflessness was a kind of vice in itself, really. She believed that self-interest was the best way to approach things, because in that way, you know, everybody got what they wanted, really, in some way. I think she was damaged, really, by she was growing up in Soviet Russia at that time, and she saw how the sort of collective was used, the idea of the collective good was used to sort of get power away from ordinary people and hold them in place. So she was very suspicious of anything that was sort of left-wing or socialist in that stripe. She was against that kind of thing, but she went too far the other way, really, into almost like a circle, back to almost being authoritarian herself. And she was, in her own personal life, very authoritarian, and towards her husband and her friends and family, and the sort of little cult of people that she generated around her. She's a fascinating figure and a kind of horrifying figure at the same time.
And famously, she lived out her final days at the government trough, getting Social Security and all kinds of government money that she so despised.
Yes, I mean, the argument that was made on her behalf is that what she's paid into it all over life. Yes, that is the point of it in the first place.
You know, I couldn't help but notice that there's a thread running between the three of your books, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, and Billionaires. And that thread is Russia in the late 1920s, early 30s, when, Vladimir Putin's parents were struggling. Ayn Rand escaped And the Koch brothers' father, Fred, got his start there in the oil business.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Eastern Europe, Germany. Fred Koch actually worked in the sort of pre-Second World War Germany as well, was connected with the Nazi movement. And he also was a founding member of the Birch Society as well. Which
Oh, the John Birch Society, yes.
Yes. It was a very extreme authoritarian movement. So these things keep cropping up all the time. It's hard for us to see as individuals because we live sort of relatively short lives, but the sort of process of history are very long and often work out much longer than our lives. So we're seeing almost like the re-emergence of the Soviet Union again in Russia, like old systems coming back, despite the fact that all the people originated are long dead, and yet it's coming back again. It's hard to see what the connections are, where it really works. Really, but it's like some things just persist through time in some mysterious way, really. There's probably concrete reasons for this, but whatever those concrete reasons are, it does elude me, and perhaps there's a book to be written on that subject.
I was just thinking there's an irony in that the one multi-billionaire that you're profiling, who actually came from a poor background, was Vladimir Putin. And if Senator Joe McCarthy or any of the John Birch Society people were around today, they might consider Vladimir Putin a great example of a rags-to-riches character, a real Horatio Alger type.
Well, that's true. You could see it that way, but he had a lot of help along the way, didn't he, really?
Well, they all do, don't they?
Well, they do. Yeah, that's true.
There's a book. In England, it's known as Science Tales. In the U.S., it's known as How to Fake a Moon Landing, Exposing the Myths of Science Denial. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, I wanted to do a science book, and I was particularly interested in subjects which is not really well understood by the general public, or there was a lot of misinformation about them. It's a theme of mine, really. So I'm looking around, and I was listening to a lot of science podcasts, and it seemed that the same subjects, misunderstood subjects that they were addressing, were coming up time and time again. They're almost self-selecting, really. Things like evolution, which is not controversial, particularly in Europe, but it is in many parts of the world, and even the United States. Various alternative therapies like homeopathy and chiropractic. Vaccination, this is before on COVID. I wrote a chapter about the anti-vax movement as it then was, and the MMR vaccine, particularly the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, and how people are associating that with autism. There's absolutely no connection between the two, but that myth persists, really. So I wrote a book about all these things. So yeah, it was an interesting book to do. Perhaps I should revisit a subject at some point.
Yeah, I was interested when I saw you talk about your artistic influences that there weren't a whole lot of cartoonists in there. I suppose George Grosz counts, but you're very fond of early 20th century German illustrators like Egon Schiele and Gustav Klimt.
Yeah, they were, when I was at art college, they were sort of the flavor of the time, really. People were always very interested in those kind of illustrators. But I'm a comics reader from a kid, so the influence of like Jack Kirby and people like that are still like quite kind of profound. Not necessarily showing up in my artwork, but the way I sort of think about comics and layout come from years of reading mainstream superhero stuff. I'm certainly not dismissive of superhero stuff in any way. Some great writers have worked in that, and artists have worked in that medium. I recently got two big collections of Mike Mignola's Hellboy, and I love that artwork. I wish I could draw as well as he can. I'm not a young person, and after a few decades, you get so many experiences. It's hard to know any more after a while what your influences have been, because it's such a massive mixture of things. When you're certainly young, when you're in your 20s or a teenager, you can sort of see just a few things, a handful of things perhaps influencing you. By the time you get to your early 60s, you've seen, read too much stuff to know where it's all coming from. And in a way, that's a rather beautiful thing, really, because there's such this great mass of influences coming through and just pours out of you if you let it.
So your art style in all of these books, these graphic nonfiction books, Billionaires, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, it's very minimal, almost iconic.
My approach really is to make things as simple visually as possible. To the information I'm trying to get across is so complex, you don't really want to get in the way, really, of the text. You want to, you don't want people wondering where to look on the page first, or try to keep to a grid system so you know exactly where to start reading it. So you're sort of reading it very simply. It's like good editing in a movie. You shouldn't be aware of the cuts. You just see the movement of the film as it moves along. And I don't want people to be aware, really, of the frames. So I take a very simple approach. I take a sort of muted colour scheme, just so that people can just sort of fall into the book and get the information directly, not try to be too clever with the visuals, really.
Yeah, the where characters are interacting, there's a lot of gestures, but not always faces.
No, I think I've changed my style a bit as I've gone along. I've gone, well, Putin was more photographically based than I've done before, basically because I wanted it to be, you know, as realistic as possible. There are cartoon sections in it, but I try to go for a more straightforward sort of illustrative style. But I think I've probably got to the end of that kind of style. My next book, whatever it will be much more cartoonier in approach, I think.
What can you tell us about this upcoming project?
Well, much to everyone's surprise, I've decided to do like a work of fiction next. And I'm going to leave non-fiction behind, just write an actual proper graphic novel, which I originally, when I came into cartoons, started doing cartooning, I was a fiction writer. So I'm really returning to my roots in doing a book that's like a sort of gothic novel, really. The story of a family who face a series of supernatural crises, and is set in two time periods in England in the early 70s and the 1820s. So it's like strange, like a mix of Regency era stuff and 1970s stuff.
Well, you are fond of science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, so it's my attempt to do sort of like a Hammer film, if you like, really.
Ah, yes. The
grew up on as a teenager, so I love those things.
The classic 1960s and 70s horror films.
Yeah, very much so.
You have a webcomic strip called The Streets of San Diablo. It involves a couple of characters named Super Sam and John of the Night. The Streets of San Diablo is sort of a Western set in the afterlife. It's on land leased from hell.
Yeah, well, I originally started because I was asked to do a strip for the Forbidden Planet book chain for their website. So I just started to do this Super Sam strip, which originally was like a 3 or 4 panel gag strip. Eventually, like a storyline emerged, and that became like The Streets of San Diablo. I may come back to that at some point.
Soon to be a major motion picture from Alex Cox.
That'd be good. I'd like to see a film from Alex Cox, really.
It seems like there's some influences in there from horror films or the likes of Guillermo del Toro or somebody.
I think it's partly Sergio Leone, but certainly I wanted to do something set in the afterlife because I wanted to have characters who had died.
You've had experience with acute depression, and you also early on, you worked as a healthcare assistant on an acute psychiatric ward. That led to a book that you published called Psychiatric Tales.
That's true. That was the first book, really, that got me into this taking sort of big subjects and then writing, drawing sort of explanatory comics about them. And that came about because I've been working as a sort of untrained healthcare assistant on an acute psychiatric ward. And after a few years, I thought, well, I might as well get trained as a mental health nurse because I'm basically doing the job anyway. So it's a 3-year course. And after about 2 years, and I've been doing the job for 5 or 6 years at this point, I realized I was completely burned out and could not continue. And it was having massive effects on my own mental health. So I had to stop, really. But out of that experience, I thought, because people kept coming to me and saying, well, I don't know how you can do that job, it must be really tough. I realized that people didn't really understand what it was like. They didn't understand what it was like to work in mental health, but they didn't really understand, more to the point, what mental illness was in all the sort of variations. So I wrote this book, Psychiatric Tales, which is sort of chapter by chapter, looks at different mental health issues like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, that kind of thing, and sort of try to break down the myths and get rid of this sort of stigma that's attached to a lot of these things, these illnesses. So that was my first book. And I couldn't initially get a publisher, so I just started sticking these short strips online, and I got an enormous following. And then publishers came to me, and then the rest is Daryl Cunningham history, basically. That's how it all happened. So what I always tell young cartoonists is really sort of build a following first online, and then you've got like something to bring to publishers, because otherwise it's difficult for them to assess you, really, rather than the old days, which is much more difficult, sending stuff by the post, and eventually it'll end up on a kind of slush pile. And then some intern might look at it after about 3 months. Now you've got instant access, and you might as well use that.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today has been Daryl Cunningham. He's the author of the graphic nonfiction books Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, How to Fake a Moon Landing, and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Daryl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I very much enjoyed this long, long talk. Thank you.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your books, your other comics, your science fiction stuff, where would they look?
I've website, but I'm on Facebook, Twitter. You can access my publisher, Drawn and Quarterly, Myriad Editions in the UK. So, you know, stick my name in Google, it'll all come up.
And that's Daryl with 2 R's and a Y.
That's right, yeah, 2 R's and a Y.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying our special programming for KBOO's Winter Membership Drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO, or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture. Oh,
listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.